Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We've got some current events which involve some celebrities. We've got lots of politics and surprise, surprise, Bess Levin is back. I have no idea when it happened, but we've got a couple articles from Bess Levin to end our hour with. So we're going to start with a diagnosis. Billy Joel cancels all concerts following a brain disorder diagnosis. The Piano Man singer has been diagnosed with normal pressure hydrocephalus, which can cause mobility and cognitive issues. This is by Eve Beatty on May 24th. Billy Joel, the best-selling singer and songwriter behind chart toppers like Uptown Girl and Piano Man, announced Friday that he's canceling an upcoming large-scale concert tour after a diagnosis of normal pressure hydrocephalus, a disorder in which an accumulation of fluid near the brain causes issues with movement and cognition. The condition was aggravated by his performance schedule, a statement from Joel says, so he's pausing all public appearances for now while he works to recover. The 76-year-old Long Island resident, whose career began in the early 1970s, wrapped up a record-breaking residency at Madison Square Garden in 2024, where he'd played around once a month since 2013. Billy Joel's 150th show in the run, to which it appears it would commute via the Long Island Railroad, went down last July, after which Joel began plans for a two-year multi-country tour where he would still have been joined by superstars such as Stevie Nicks, Sting, and Rod Stewart. The tour was expected to kick off in April, but its opening show in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, along with seven subsequent dates, were postponed in March. According to a statement posted to Joel's social media accounts, Billy Joel has announced that he will be canceling all scheduled concerts following a recent diagnosis of normal pressure hydrocephalus, or NPH. This condition has been exacerbated by recent concert performances, leading to problems with hearing, vision, and balance. Under his doctor's instructions, the statement continues, Billy is undergoing specific physical therapy and has been advised to refrain from performing during this recovery period. Billy is thankful for the excellent care he's receiving and is fully committed to prioritizing his health. He's grateful for the support from fans during this time and looks forward to the day when he can once again take the stage. I'm sincerely sorry to disappoint our audience, and thank you for your understanding, the statement concluded. A representative for Joel referred Vanity Fair to the public statement but did not provide additional comment. According to Johns Hopkins Medical, NPH occurs when an excess of cerebrospinal fluid accumulates in the ventricles of the brain, causing them to enlarge and cause pressure to nearby brain tissue. Symptoms include sudden struggles with balance and walking, mood changes and confusion, and difficulty answering questions. Surgical intervention is typically used to release the fluid, followed by therapies to help the patient regain mobility and cognition. When diagnosed swiftly, a full recovery is often possible. Another update on a celebrity, Emma Heming Willis and Bruce Willis's future plans vanished after his dementia diagnosis. At an Alzheimer's forum, Willis's wife revealed that the actor's health challenges have meant for her marriage. This is by Marita Alonso on May 28th. On March 21st, model and businesswoman Emma Heming Willis uploaded an emotional image to her social networks. It was a picture of Heming Willis with her husband, Bruce Willis, which she shared to celebrate their 16th anniversary. "We've shared monumental highs and devastating lows, and through it all, we've built something timeless," she wrote. "I'm so deeply grateful for every chapter I've had with him and all the ones we'll continue to write in our language of unconditional love." This Monday, at the Women's Alzheimer's Movement Forum, she explained to those in attendance that everything she and her husband had planned for the rest of their lives went up in smoke the instant he was diagnosed with frontotemporal dementia 3 years ago. The year before, he and his family announced that Willis would step away from acting due to an ongoing health concern. "The day Bruce received the diagnosis, we left the office with a brochure and an empty goodbye. No plan, no guidance, no hope, just shock," Heming Willis said. "The future we had planned vanished before our eyes, and I was left trying to hold my family together, raise our two young daughters, and care for the man I love while dealing with a disease I barely understood. I felt lost, isolated, and scared. What I needed at that moment, at that appointment, was not just medical information. I needed someone to look me in the eye and say, "This seems impossible right now, but you will find your balance. You will survive this, and you will grow because of it," she continued. But since she didn't find that support, Hemming Willis decided to write a book to help those facing a similar situation. On September 9th, she'll publish The Unexpected Journey, the sort of book she wishes she had received on the day of Willis's diagnosis. It's a supportive guide to coping with the experience of caring for a loved one. "This is the book I trust will help the next caregiver," she wrote in April after revealing the book's cover on Instagram. "It is filled with support, insight, and the hope needed to navigate this journey." Next up in the Hollywood section, Lindsay Lohan is moving on from the Netflix rom-com I Can't Do Movies Like These Forever. This is by Savannah Walsh on May 27th. After reaching teen stardom in the 2000s, Lindsay Lohan spent some time away from mainstream Hollywood, making her return with a trio of Netflix romantic comedies: 2022's Falling for Christmas, 2024's Irish Wish, and Our Little Secret. In a new Elle cover story, Lohan shared that she was manifesting her comeback during the pandemic. "I was like, I want to work with Netflix. I kept writing it in my journal and saying it, and then that's what happened. I was like, oh, it'd be nice to do 3 films with them and see where that goes." But while the 38-year-old actor always wants to front films that can make people happy and bring people together, she's finally through with Netflix romantic comedies, at least for the moment. "I love making movies for that reason, for people to escape and find something that they can take into their own life and realize everything's going to be okay," Lohan told the publication. "But with Netflix, I was like, okay, now we need to be thinking about other stuff. I can't do movies like these forever." Next up, Lohan stars in Freakier Friday, out August 8th, a sequel to 2003's Freaky Friday that reunites her with co-star Jamie Lee Curtis. "There's not a lot bringing me to the movie theaters personally right now. Freakier Friday is a feel-good movie, which is what I want to give people," said Lohan, who also relished getting to share the experience with her husband, financier Bader Shamas, and her son, Luai. "I mean, it's the most important thing. My husband, my son, and me. It's all about balance and, as I said, routine," she told Saturday Night Live's Chloe Fineman in the Elle interview. "Especially when you have a kid, routine is the most important thing, and whatever their routine is, I've got to live by that." Lohan says she's now ready to switch up her day-to-day by welcoming a second child. "Once you have one kid, you're like, oh, my kid needs a kid to play with. I'm like, he needs a friend. Also, I don't know if it's selfish, but I'm like, I need more than one kid to take care of me when I'm older." Speaking of aging, Lohan also revealed that she's developing her own beauty line and shared some of her own secrets to looking fresh-faced, from drinking lemon juice and using daily eye patches to undergoing skincare treatments like Morpheus 8. Lohan only tried it once, and injections. Everyone does Botox. As for the next phase of her career, Lohan will be starring in a Hulu adaptation of Sophie Stava's debut novel, Count My Lies, Elle reports, and has some ideas for what might follow. "I would love to find a dark comedy like Mean Girls, that kind of meaty, good, funny movie, a smart comedy, not a rom-com, just a straightforward, funny movie," she said. "I'd also like to work with some dream directors, maybe Quentin Tarantino. I'd also love to work with Julianne Moore. I don't know why I've never played her daughter. Maybe now I'd be her younger sister. I'd also love to work with Robert De Niro and Al Pacino. Maybe something Sopranos-y, since I'm Italian." Our next headline in the Hollywood section: Joan Baez thinks Timothy Chalamet was quote-unquote too clean to play Bob Dylan. This is by Valentina Colosimo on May 27th. The question, alas, comes right away. "I was hoping the first question would not even have his name," laughs Joan Baez. Though the folk music icon has fought many battles, perhaps the longest has been her fight against being labeled Bob Dylan's ex. "I understand you can't help it," Baez continues. "I know I can't. Once in my life, I had an interview that was just me. It was a German guy, and he gave a whole interview, and he never brought up the name. When we were finished, I said, hallelujah." Now, 60 years after her relationship with Dylan, legendary, turbulent, artistically powerful Baez is used to being asked about him. Not by Dylan himself, though. Last year, Dylan gave his seal of approval to A Complete Unknown, a biopic starring Timothée Chalamet as Dylan and Monica Barbaro as Baez. Both got Oscar nominations for their performances. I had an interview with Rolling Stone the other day, and they said, "Did Bob reach out to you about the movie?" And I said, "You've been working at Rolling Stone long enough to know the answer to that question," Baez said. "He doesn't reach out to anybody, but I reached out to Monica and to, I never remember his name, the one who played Pete Seeger, that would be Edward Norton. We had a long conversation. Would it be possible for her to reach out to Dylan herself?" Baez's answer is short, no. The now 84-year-old Baez moves slowly and smiles widely, the usual thousand bangles clanging on her wrists. The voice that sang, "We shall overcome," amid tear gas and marches on the bridges of Alabama, arrived in Milan recently to present her new book of poems and prose, "When You See My Mother, Ask Her to Dance," before visiting the Milanesia to have a dialogue with Sandro Veronesi. Though her legendary vibrato is still powerful, she shares it at one point, singing a few lines from Janis Ian's One in a Million, Baez is done with live performance. "I don't want to tour anymore," she said. "Too tiring. The tour bus, the transfers, I can't do it anymore. But writing is still a way to endure. And to remember the past. A Complete Unknown," Baez says, "is not a documentary, it's a movie. Some of it's beautiful. The music was beautiful, and some of the acting. I think she did a good job," she adds, referring to Barbaro. "I think he did a very good job. What's his name? Chalamet. He was too clean, probably." Baez's new book includes a poem dedicated to Jimi Hendrix, "I Didn't Know Him Well," and a focus on her own childhood. "Early in my life, drawing gave me my own identity and was soothing to me. And then it was early childhood trauma. It was abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse. So all my life I had phobias and I had troubles and anxiety and I didn't understand why. But I had good therapists. They helped me function, but the deep problems were still there. Writing then provides her a different kind of therapy." Childhood is referenced in the book's title. Baez also speaks of her father, physicist Albert Baez, who refused to work on the Manhattan Project for religious reasons. His influence led Baez to embrace civil disobedience. "I was raised Quaker," she says. "It's the only religion that seriously does not go to war. Everybody says you shouldn't kill anybody, and then they strap on the guns and they go and fight. And the Quakers really won't do that. They say you can accept suffering, but you can't inflict suffering." It's a viewpoint she wishes more people in power shared. When asked whether she anticipated Donald Trump's being elected president a second time, Baez replies, "No, but no matter what, nobody could have realized, nobody could write it, nobody could dream it. What we have now is so fast and so destructive, we just can't let it destroy the heart and the art. It's impossible to imagine," she continues. "It's still impossible. Every day when you get up, something more disgusting has happened than the day before. And that's really the best word. It's disgusting, and it's cruel. And the point of it is cruelty. The point of it is to hurt people. The point of it is sadism." What about music? Can it still change things? Maybe. But Baez thinks we desperately need a new anthem. The strongest anthem ever was "We Shall Overcome." Everybody could sing it, and it gave us a feeling that we were together, and we were powerful. Others have tried writing songs that have equal power, she says. Some are even pretty good, but Baez also thinks we will never have that 10-year period again of all that talent, which flourished in the 1960s. In the meantime, Baez writes poetry, and has crashed her newly bought Tesla. "Yes, I did," she said to laughter. "God was speaking to me because I got this car. Literally, I was trying it out. I drove for 45 minutes. I drove home. Boom. I backed into a big tree and it was destroyed. Perhaps it was a sign." This next article is mixing a little celebrity with politics. Gavin Newsom mingles with rock stars at Bottle Rock Music Fest. This is by Eve Beatty on May 25th. Governor Gavin Newsom was living the California dream this weekend. The former mayor of San Francisco headed to the northern edges of the Bay Area Saturday for Bottle Rock, a three-day music festival geared primarily to the elder millennial and Gen X set, see last year's Bradley Cooper / Pearl Jam collab, which is arguably the high-profile politician's target demo. Or is it? Depends on the day, I suppose. Gavin Newsom, who launched a podcast earlier this year on which he has platformed legitimately problematic people, such as conservative activist and anti-vaxxer Charlie Kirk, and recently imprisoned alleged booster of the January 6th attempt to overthrow democracy, Steve Bannon, was hanging out backstage at the fest on Saturday, alongside folks including Marsha Vlasic, the talent manager for musician Neil Young. Is it perhaps Vlasic's presence that spurred Newsom to tell a San Francisco Chronicle staffer that Neil Young has shown incredible integrity, a reference to the Rocking in the Free World singer's repeated statements of opposition to the politics of President Donald Trump? This is an incredibly important moment in U.S. history, Newsom said. It's about free expression and being accountable. We can't afford to be timid. Young has opposed Trump's use of his anti-GOP anthem at campaign events since 2015, when the then-reality star launched his initial grab for the White House. He had to repeat himself in 2020 when Trump's campaign rolled the song out again, this time at a rally at Mount Rushmore. A monument, by the way, that Trump may or may not wish to be added to. Although glass half full, it'll sure be tougher to carve Trump's mug on that cliff if he gets his way and tanks all our national parks. Young escalated this criticism of Trump last week after the president appeared to pick a social media fight with Young contemporary Bruce Springsteen. "I'm not scared of you. Neither are the rest of us," Young wrote online. "You shut down FEMA when we needed it most. That's your problem, Trump. Stop thinking about what rockers are saying. Think about saving America from the mess you made. Taylor Swift is right. So is Bruce. You know how I feel. You're more worried about yourself than America. You're forgetting your real job. You work for us." Newsom has taken his own principled stand against Trump in the past, but that tone has changed in 2025. Take, for example, Newsom's speech after he successfully defeated a recall attempt in 2021, in which he said his triumph was a referendum on California's, and presumably his, values. "We said yes to vaccines," Newsom said from the podium. "We said yes to people's right to vote without fear of fake fraud and voter suppression. We said yes to women's fundamental constitutional right to decide for herself what she does with her body, her faith, her future. We said yes to diversity. We said yes to inclusion. We said yes to pluralism. We said yes to all those things that we hold dear as Californians and, I would argue, as Americans." That's the same guy who, after Trump was reelected, sat with Charlie Kirk, an alleged anti-Semite who says women shouldn't use birth control, and failed to question those or other past statements made by the Turning Point USA founder. In fact, he agreed with Kirk's anti-trans remarks around the straw man misdirection of transgender women who play sports. Newsom broke important ground in 2004 when he instructed San Francisco officials to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples just months into his first term as mayor. It was a risky move and one that likely slowed his political ascent, with Newsom once complaining that Barack Obama worked to avoid sharing a stage with Newsom lest he be linked to the San Franciscans' work toward marriage equality. Nearly 20 years later, it's Newsom who's edging toward the national stage and, perhaps necessarily, away from the forward-thinking positions he once took. I wonder if his praise of Young yesterday is tinged with a little bit of jealousy, perhaps as he remembers a time when he happily told bigots that the future is coming whether you like it or not, instead of kissing up to them. A time when Newsom was, in his words, far less timid. This next headline is a bit of current events mixed with politics. The still vital and still complicated legacy of Susan Brown Miller. An activist and author of the landmark rape study, Against Our Will, lived long enough to see the struggle is still just beginning. This is by Joy Press on May 27th. I met Susan Brown Miller, the feminist pioneer, while researching a project about 1960s groups like New York Radical Women and Red Stockings. We had both worked at the Village Voice, she 2 decades before me, and Brown Miller welcomed me into her Greenwich Village area like I was a long-lost niece, regaling me with tales of yore. There was her time spent in the civil rights movement as a summer volunteer in Mississippi, her illegal abortions and abortion protests, the disruptive occupation of Ladies' Home Journal as a throwdown to a male-dominated media, the first rape speak out, which led to her groundbreaking, controversial 1975 book, Against Our Will, Men, Women, and Rape. She talked about how the women's liberationists faced opposition not just from the establishment, but from macho progressive activists who ought to have been their allies. Radical men didn't like the idea of women splitting off into their own groups, she recalled with a sly grin. Who was going to run the mimeograph machines or get the coffee? When I heard she had died this week at the age of 90, I immediately pulled up the YouTube video of her 1970 appearance on The Dick Cavett Show, in which she and fellow voice writer Sally Kempton took down Playboy founder Hugh Hefner with a perfect mixture of chutzpah and disdain. Clad in a no-nonsense beige pantsuit, Brown Miller announced, "Hugh Hefner is my enemy." The 44-year-old publisher sat just a few feet away, suavely puffing on his pipe, doing his best to look unruffled. "The role you have selected for women is degrading," Brown Miller said coolly of the Playboy bunnies with their cottontail rears and the cheesecake models in the magazine, "because you choose to see women as sex objects, not as full human beings." Hefner tried to smooth the waters and meet women's lib halfway while standing up for vive la différence. "I'm more in sympathy than the girls realize," Hefner assured the audience. "Women," Brown Miller retorted, correcting Hefner's use of the word girls. "Women, I am 35. And she turned it right back on the aging swinger, asking sharply, "Do you want to be called a boy?" At a moment when many gains of the women's movement are being reversed at warp speed, when ever more draconian abortion laws mean that a brain-dead woman in Georgia is being kept alive on life support until her fetus is viable, when the White House is aggressively erasing women's achievements from the public record and attacking programs to increase workplace equality, the changes that Brown Miller fought for now seem miraculous. Brown Miller grew up in Brooklyn, the child of a lower-middle-class Jewish family. A college dropout, she changed her name from Warfdig to Brown Miller because she hoped to break into the theater. When the stage life didn't pan out, she switched her sights to magazines, but realized while working at Newsweek that in the mainstream media, women writers like her wouldn't be allowed to rise past researcher. So she became a freelance journalist, writing for places like The Voice. In fall 1968, she heard about a New York Radical Women meeting. That was the name of the group behind the disruption of the Miss America pageant, most famous for a symbolic protest in which the female protesters hurled cosmetics in a trash can and, so the legend goes, burned their bras. That never actually happened, but the myth of the lingerie inferno went viral, a fictitious spark that ignited real outbreaks of women's liberation across the world, while setting off alarm bells throughout the straight world. When Brown Miller arrived at the meeting for her first consciousness-raising session a few months after the pageant, the room was packed. The topic was having children. As soon as her turn came around, Brown Miller found herself blurting out details of the three illegal abortions she'd had, one just 6 months before in Puerto Rico. She had thought she was in control, but tears welled up in her eyes as she told the women she felt lucky to be alive. "I had never said this out loud before," Brown Miller recalled. "That was the moment I knew this women's movement was real." She threw herself into the maelstrom and soon was testifying about her abortions as part of a massive class-action abortion-related lawsuit, a precursor to Roe v. Wade, organized by activist lawyer Flo Kennedy. Kennedy saw the suit as not just a legal action, but an attempt to educate the public about the need for abortion to be legalized. Brown Miller did just that. She talked about a doctor who wanted to experiment on her with a new method, asking her to sign blank pieces of paper that would absolve him of guilt in case the abortion went awry. At the start of 1970, women's liberation remained a curiosity to most Americans. By the year's end, the effects of the movement had seeped into every area of modern life. One of the most dramatic uprisings of the year unfolded within the media itself. Spurred by the impact of the Miss America protests, Brown Miller and a group called Media Women decided to stage a sit-in at the Ladies' Home Journal, a bastion of this counter-revolution since 1891, sedating its 14 million female readers with monthly columns like, "Can This Marriage Be Saved?" On the morning of March 18, 1970, dozens of women's liberation activists, dressed in office-appropriate dresses and heels, swarmed the inner sanctum of Editor-in-Chief John Mack Carter, laying siege for 11 hours. "Behave like ladies," pleaded Lenore Hershey, Carter's genteel deputy and gatekeeper. Instead, the invaders passed around a box of Carter's cigars and smoked them. They hung a banner outside the editor's window proclaiming the Women's Liberated Journal. NBC News captured the scene on tape as dozens of women confronted Carter. "Do you women recognize one leader?" a magazine staffer asked, hoping for a less chaotic negotiation. "No," the protesters shouted joyfully. Prior to the office invasion, Brown Miller and her comrades had compiled a list of demands to present to the magazine. Most major women's periodical mastheads were still dominated by men, so they called for Carter, along with other top editors and staff writers, to be replaced by women. They also pressed for a daycare center for employees and the hiring of black women at all levels. At a time, there were precisely zero on the staff. Their most audacious goal was to not just occupy the offices for a day, but to take over an entire issue of the magazine. Article ideas included how to get an abortion and how to have an orgasm, both verboten topics in the demure women's magazines of the era. They even mocked up a magazine cover featuring a pregnant woman holding up a sign that read, "Unpaid Labor." Carter ultimately agreed to give them an 8-page magazine supplement that would be written and edited collectively. Among those working on the special section were Media Women member Nora Ephron, then a writer at the New York Post. Alternatingly fascinating, horrifying, and hilarious is how Ephron later described the fractious experience. After the sit-in, however, Ladies' Home Journal instituted significant changes. Carter refocused the existing Power of a Woman section to cover women's liberation happenings and added a new monthly Working Woman column. And a few years later, Hershey took his place as editor-in-chief. Yet some felt disappointed by how few concessions they'd won from the magazine, and the underground newspaper, RAT, accused Brown Miller and her fellow journalists of using the action for personal gain, suggesting that they'd turned a guerrilla action into a job interview. Late in 1970, Brown Miller's consciousness-raising group began discussing the topic of rape. "Rape isn't a feminist issue," she insisted. Having never been assaulted herself, Brown Miller initially couldn't see how any sensible woman could end up in a situation. But her perspective changed completely as she listened to fellow members' stories, and she decided to help the group plan a rape speak out. On a chilly January afternoon in a Hell's Kitchen church, 30 women stood up to testify to an array of ordeals. The perpetrators ranged from trusted intimates, psychiatrists, husbands, boyfriends, to total strangers. The group followed the speak-out a few months later with a full-scale rape conference, featuring workshops and talks devoted to the law, social policy, medical issues, incest, and self-defense. Brown Miller attended on crutches. She'd sprained her ankle by kicking a guy on the street who pinched her while she was handing out conference flyers. Propelled by the momentum of the conference, Brown Miller launched herself into researching what would become the first major feminist study of rape, Against Our Will. "A nuts and bolts program for dragging rape laws on into our 20th century," said the New York Times. It led to Times Magazine honoring Brown Miller as one of its 12 Women of the Year in 1975. But the book was also rightly critiqued by scholars like Bell Hooks and Angela Davis for its blind spots regarding race. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you're listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We're currently reading from an article from vanityfair.com about the legacy of Susan Brown Miller. While acknowledging Against Our Will is a pioneering scholarly contribution to the contemporary literature of rape, Davis condemned it as a text pervaded with racist ideas. In a passage on Emmett Till, the black teenager lynched in 1955 for whistling at a white woman in a Mississippi grocery store, Brown Miller described the boy's whistle as a deliberate insult just short of physical assault, suggesting that black and white men alike see women as the white man's property. Davis noted that Brown Miller's rendering, Till comes off looking almost as guilty as his white racist murderers. An unabashed and imperfect feminist heroine, Brown Miller continued to stir up controversy by making comments late in life that sounded like victim blaming. "Culture may tell you, you can drink as much as men, but you can't," Brown Miller told The Cut in 2015. "The slut marches bothered me too when they said you can wear whatever you want. Well, sure, but you look like a hooker. They say that doesn't matter, but it matters to the man who wants to rape." Throughout her career, some of Brown Miller's fellow feminists resented her high-profile status. Even as she was writing Against Our Will, Brown Miller recalls one of her cohorts asking her, "Why do you have to put your name on your book? These ideas belong to the movement," which is why she brought her friend Sally Kempton on The Dick Cavett Show with her. When Cavett asked them if they rejected men, Brown Miller told him that she was more optimistic about the possibility of men changing than separatist feminists. "Still," she said thoughtfully, "we think there's going to be a struggle, and we don't think that men are going to give up their power and privilege easily." Brown Miller lived long enough to understand that in a war there can be setbacks, that ground gained can be reconquered, and that the struggle is still just beginning. We are heading into the politics section. Our first headline, why is Trump pardoning Julie and Todd Crisley, the reality TV couple convicted of fraud? This is by Savannah Walsh on May 28th. "One can always rely on Donald Trump to help a fellow reality star in need. This time, they're Julie and Todd Crisley, who headlined the hit series Crisley Knows Best, and were convicted of bank fraud and tax evasion charges in 2022. The Crisleys were found guilty of both evading taxes and conspiracy to defraud community banks out of more than $30 million to fund their lavish lifestyle, as seen on TV. Julie was also found guilty of wire fraud and obstruction of justice, and their accountant, Peter Tarantino, was found guilty of multiple tax crimes as well, including conspiring to defraud the IRS and filing two false corporate tax returns on behalf of the Crisleys' company. Tarantino was sentenced to 3 years in federal prison, while his former clients, Julie and Todd, were sentenced to 7 and 12 years, respectively. As today's outcomes show, when you lie, cheat, and steal, justice is blind as to your fame, your fortune, and your position, Carrie Farley, special agent in charge of FBI Atlanta, said in a statement at the time of the conviction. In the end, when driven by greed, the verdict of guilty on all counts for these three defendants proves once again that financial crimes do not pay. But just 3 years later, the Crisleys have seized a get-out-of-jail-free card from President Trump, with their pardons likely to be signed Wednesday, a White House official familiar with the plans told The Washington Post. A video posted on X by White House communications advisor Margo Martin shows Trump on a call in the Oval Office with the Crisleys' 27-year-old daughter, Savannah. "Your parents are going to be free and clean, and I hope we can do it by tomorrow," Trump said on the call, joined by his administration's pardon czar, Alice Marie Johnson. Trump added of the Crisleys, "They were given pretty harsh treatment based on what I'm hearing. I don't know them, but give them my regards and wish them a good life." In a subsequent appearance on News Nation, On Balance, Savannah Crisley said Trump spoke with her on the phone saying, "You guys don't look like terrorists." Ahead, a breakdown of the Crisley's crimes conviction and a reality TV comeback already percolating over on Lifetime. So who are the Crisleys? The Crisleys shot to fame about a decade ago with the 2014 debut of their USA Network reality show, Crisley Knows Best. That sitcom-style series follows Todd and Julie, multimillionaire Christian real estate moguls, raising five kids in a sprawling Atlanta mansion. On the show, which spawned spinoffs, Growing Up Crisley and According to Crisley, members of the clan regularly flaunt both their luxurious lifestyle and madcap family dynamics involving Todd's mother, affectionately known as Nanny Faye. But according to prosecutors in the Crisley case, their public reputation was based on the lie that their wealth came from dedication and hard work. In fact, the prosecution said, the Crisleys were career swindlers who've made their living by jumping from one fraud scheme to another, lying to banks, stiffing vendors, and evading taxes at every corner. The Crisleys have denied any wrongdoing. The 10-season run of Crisley Knows Best ended when the couple began their respective prison sentences in 2023, but their reality TV empire has not crumbled entirely. According to Variety, cable channel Lifetime has greenlit an untitled docuseries about the family following Todd's and Julie's convictions, with elder children Savannah and Chase serving as executive producers. An official synopsis reads, "The family faces the challenges of carrying on the Crisley name and legacy on their own with only phone calls and brief visits with their incarcerated parents. While Savannah maintains custody of her younger siblings, Chloe and Grayson, she's been fighting tirelessly for a presidential pardon to free her parents. Meanwhile, Chase is addressing some life struggles while building his new business and navigating his relationship with girlfriend Jody." Why did they get sent to prison? Well, around the time that Crisley Knows Best premiered in 2014, Todd filed for bankruptcy, while Julie falsified financial documents and lied to real estate agents in order to secure their high-end rental home in Los Angeles, according to the Northern District of Georgia's Department of Justice. When the pair failed to make rent payments, the property owner filed an eviction lawsuit against the Crisleys. Prior to the start of their reality show, the Crisleys submitted false bank statements, audit reports, and personal financial statements to banks to obtain the millions of dollars in fraudulent loans, said U.S. Attorney Ryan K. Buchanan. The couple then used the funds to obtain expensive cars, designer clothing, travel, and real estate. According to Buchanan, old loans were reimbursed through the use of new fraudulent ones. Then, after earning millions from their reality show, the Crisleys failed to pay back more than $500,000 in taxes owed by Todd. According to prosecutors, they failed to pay taxes or filed returns from 2013 to 2016. Last year, an appeals court held the convictions of Todd and the Crisley accountant, Tarantino, but vacated Julie's sentence, ruling that the sentencing judge had held her liable for the entirety of the bank fraud scheme without specific evidence pointing to her involvement before 2007. So why is Trump pardoning them? Short answer, eldest Crisley child Savannah is a vocal Trump supporter who has spent time in the magosphere advocating for her parents' release. Last summer, Savannah spoke at the Republican National Convention, where she claimed the Crisleys had been persecuted by the rogue prosecutors for their conservative beliefs. "I'll never forget what the prosecutor said in the most heavily Democratic county in the state before an Obama-appointed judge. He called us the Trumps of the South," she alleged, adding, "He meant it as an insult, but let me tell you, boy, do I wear it as a badge of honor." Savannah also paid a visit to the White House in March, and earlier this month she was interviewed by the president's daughter-in-law, Lara Trump, on Fox News, and she knows her audience. Trump loves a strategic pardon. In one of his first acts after being sworn into office for a second term, Trump pardoned more than 1,500 of those convicted in connection with the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. On Monday, he offered similar reprieve to Scott Jenkins, a former Virginia sheriff who was sentenced to 10 years in prison after being convicted on fraud and bribery charges. "The president called me personally as I was walking into Sam's Club and notified me that he was signing paper pardon paperwork for both of my parents," Savannah said in an Instagram video on Tuesday, May 27th. Wearing a gold Make America Great Again hat, she continued, "I will forever be grateful for President Trump, his administration, and everyone along the way, all of my lawyers, the people who put in countless hours and effort and love for my family to make sure that my parents got home." Well-wishers in the comments section included Brittany Aldean, conservative wife of country music Jason Aldean, and former Real Housewives of Atlanta star Kim Zolciak-Bierman. The Crisley's attorney, Alex Little, said in a statement Tuesday that the pardon corrects a deep injustice and restores two devoted parents to their family and community, adding that Todd and Julie's case is exactly why the pardon power exists. Thanks to President Trump, the Crisley family can now begin healing and rebuilding their lives. Our next headline is What Trump Really Wants from Tim Cook. This is by Izzy Lepowski on May 27th. Donald Trump was still a recently canned reality star and an underdog candidate for the Republican presidential nomination in 2016 when he first started picking on Apple. "We're going to get Apple to build their damn computers and things in this country instead of in other countries," he said in a speech at Liberty University. But that promise never panned out. Not during Trump 1.0, not during the Biden years. Now, nearly a decade later, and despite all evidence that American-made iPhones would be unfeasibly, disastrously costly, Trump is at it again. In a post on Truth Social on Friday, Trump threatened to saddle the Cupertino tech giant with 25% tariffs if it fails to manufacture iPhones in the U.S. I have long ago informed Tim Cook of Apple that I expect their iPhones will be sold in the United States of America, will be manufactured and built in the United States, not India, not any place else, he wrote. It was an about-face from the administration's previously announced plan to specifically exempt smartphones and electronic devices from so-called reciprocal tariffs on goods from China, a deal that Apple CEO Tim Cook received no small amount of credit for negotiating. Trump's renewed threat came after Cook reportedly rebuffed the White House's invitation to join the president on his Middle East trip. It also followed shortly after the Financial Times reported that Apple's manufacturing contractor, Foxconn, is preparing to spend $1.5 billion to build a new plant in India, which will supply components to Apple. While its supply chain is still inextricably tied to China, Apple has reportedly been shifting assembly of a growing number of iPhones to India in an effort to bypass the escalating U.S.-China trade war and the on-again-off-again tariffs that have come with it. Apple simultaneously announced it would invest $500 billion in the United States in the next 4 years. But apart from a commitment to manufacture servers in Houston and chips in Arizona, the announcement was light on details about what exactly that outpouring of cash will be spent on. Most glaringly, it made no mention of American-made iPhones, and with good reason. At least one analyst has estimated that shifting manufacturing to the U.S. could drive up the cost of an iPhone to $3,500. But neither Apple's India workaround nor its vague promises to the U.S. have been sufficient. To Trump, it's the American-made iPhone that has always been the apotheosis of making America great again. It would not just be a display of the country's old-school industrial strength applied to the most ubiquitous technology of today. It would also be a show of force, exhibiting Trump's power over one of the most powerful companies in the world and the foreign countries that rely on its business. The good news for Apple and for Americans who want to be able to afford iPhones is that Trump's thirst for credit can cut both ways. True to his reality show roots, history suggests Trump is always more focused on the fanfare of an announcement than on the follow-through. Recall the ill-fated Foxconn factory in Wisconsin that Trump hailed in 2018 as the eighth wonder of the world. By the time it officially fell apart, leaving a trail of vacant buildings in its wake, Trump was long gone, and when he returned to campaign in the swing state in 2024, it was as if the whole thing had never happened. Or remember the time in 2019 when Cook took Trump on a tour of a Texas plant where an Apple contractor had been making MacBook Pros since 2013. Afterward, Trump announced on Twitter that he had just opened a major Apple manufacturing plant in Texas that will bring high-paying jobs back to America. Apple let him have it, and it was among the moments that led to Trump's chummy relationship with Cook, or as he called him, Tim Apple, during his first term. Or think back to January when OpenAI's Sam Altman, Oracle's Larry Ellison, and SoftBank's Masayoshi Son joined Trump at the White House to announce Stargate, a $100 billion AI venture that was already in the works long before Trump's election. "We wouldn't be able to do this without you, Mr. President," Altman said at the time. Apple helped write this playbook, and it would be wise to put it in action now. That may entail, as Deadbook has suggested, unveiling a plan for iPhones that are assembled in America that could leave the lion's share of the company's supplies overseas supply chain intact. Such a compromise would hardly hinder China, where Apple has invested eye-watering sums of money to establish its manufacturing base. But it could give Trump a decent photo op, which, if history serves, may be all he really wants. Our next headline, Elon Musk is playing the blame game. This is by Issy Lepowski on May 28th. Despite Elon Musk's disdain for traditional journalism, "You are the media now," he wrote to his followers on X in January. The Tesla and SpaceX CEO has sat for a battery of interviews in the last week. Speaking with CNBC, CBS, Bloomberg, The Washington Post, and Ars Technica, Musk's apparent goal seems to be to salvage his reputation and to reverse the damage done to his companies by his political maneuvering at Doge. As Musk tries to reestablish his business bona fides, he is increasingly willing to distance himself from the White House. In an interview with CBS This Morning, which is set to air in full this weekend, Musk criticized the big, beautiful bill which President Trump has championed. "I was disappointed to see the massive spending bill, frankly, which increases the budget deficit, not just decreases it, and undermines the work that the Doge team is doing," he said. "I think a bill can be big or it can be beautiful, but I don't know if it can be both." In a separate conversation with The Post, Musk claimed that Doge has become the administration's whipping boy, saying that something bad would happen anywhere and we would get blamed for it even if we had nothing to do with it. Once a permanent fixture at Trump's side, happily sucking up all the oxygen in the room during cabinet meetings and outspeaking Trump during interviews in the Oval Office, Musk is now playing the blame game. Having dialed back his time at Doge, Musk is creating the conditions to make someone or something else the fall guy when Doge inevitably fails to live up to Musk's promise to cut $2 trillion in government spending. The GOP spending bill, which is expected to increase the deficit by nearly $4 trillion and, incidentally, make electric vehicles like Tesla's more expensive to buy, just makes for an awfully convenient scapegoat. But the truth is, even without the GOP spending bill, Musk's promise was preposterous, as was his later claim that Doge would find $1 trillion in cuts by the end of May. Now Musk acts as if he never made those promises to begin with. When a Bloomberg interviewer asked him what happened to the $2 trillion promise last week, he called her question absurd in its fundamental premise, ignoring entirely his role in establishing that premise. By the Doge's website's own count, the group has cut $175 billion in spending, and even that number is tough to trust given the endless stream of errors that have already been uncovered. But even Doge's shortcomings, Musk is trying to lay at Washington's feet. "The federal bureaucracy situation is much worse than I realized," he said. "I thought there were problems, but it sure is an uphill battle trying to improve things in D.C., to say the least." Now, at least, Musk seems willing to right-size public expectations of what Doge will ultimately achieve. In his interview with The Post, he said the group will now focus on improving government technology, you know, the kind of like what the United States Digital Service was doing before Musk took it over and blew that entire mission up. All right, we're going to the Bess Levin report. It has been so long, I was so surprised to see that she is back. Macron insists wife shove was just them being sexy and French, you provincial hacks. What you saw was part of their normal repartee, okay? This was on the 27th. Emmanuel and Brigitte Macron whipped the internet and conservative media into a frenzy over the weekend when videos circulated showing the latter aggressively shoving the former's face just before they stepped off a plane in Vietnam. Were they in the midst of a domestic dispute? Does the French First Lady regularly manhandle her husband when she's seemingly unaware that cameras are rolling? Is their marriage in trouble? According to the French president, none of the above. Instead, what people saw was merely part of their standard repartee, which he doesn't expect prudes like you to understand. On Monday, Macron said that he and his wife were simply bickering and rather joking around, saying that's something we often do. Speaking to TMZ, a French official called the interaction a moment when the president and his wife were relaxing one last time before the start of the trip by having a laugh. It was a moment of closeness. Maybe in your unsophisticated circles, this sort of thing is uncommon, but for the Macrons, it's their thing. If there weren't state business to attend to, perhaps it would have led to throes of passion and a shared cigarette. Commenting on the reaction to the footage, Macron said, "I'm surprised by it. It turns into some kind of global catastrophe where people are even coming up with theories to explain it. It's nonsense." He added that conspiracy theories about footage were part of a disinformation campaign started by crazy people. Nearly 3 weeks ago, a video featuring Macron, German Chancellor Friedrich Merz, and British Prime Minister Keir Starmer showed a tissue on the table they were sitting around, leading to wild claims that it was a bag of cocaine. In response, Macron's office said in a statement, "When European unity becomes inconvenient, disinformation goes so far as to make a simple tissue look like drugs. This fake news is being spread by France's enemies, both abroad and at home. We must remain vigilant against manipulation." A right-wing French commenter told Europe One that the video of Macron indicated there may be domestic violence against men and that the French president cannot even command respect from his wife when there are cameras in front of him. In his remarks to reporters, Macron also referred to a video of a recent handshake between him and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, which he said was another source of disinformation against him. It's been 3 weeks. If you look at the international agenda of the President of the French Republic, from Kiev to Tirana to Hanoi, there are people who have watched the video and believe that I shared a bag of cocaine, that I had a mano with a Turkish president, and that right now I'm having a fight with my wife. None of this is true, he told reporters. So everyone needs to calm down and focus on the real news. Our next Levin report. Turns out that RFK Jr.'s plan to make America healthy again doesn't include most pregnant women or children. This was published on May 27th. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. announced Tuesday that the Department of Health and Human Services will no longer recommend that healthy pregnant women and children receive the COVID vaccine, despite the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention currently advising that all Americans 6 months and older receive the updated vaccine and warning that pregnancy puts people at risk of becoming seriously ill from the virus, as well as suffering serious pregnancy complications. In a sub-67 60-second video posted on X, Kennedy, who has said his brain was partially eaten by a worm that crawled inside and died, smiles while declaring he couldn't be more pleased to announce that as of today, the COVID vaccine for healthy children and healthy pregnant women has been removed from the CDC-recommended immunization schedule. He adds, "We're now one step closer to realizing President Trump's promise to make America healthy again." National Institutes of Health Director Jay Bhattacharya, who also appears in this video, as does Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Martin Makary, calls the decision common sense and good science. Makary claims there's no evidence healthy kids need it today, and most countries have stopped recommending it for children. As the Washington Post notes, the social media post did not offer a detailed explanation about the move. George C. Benjamin, the executive director of American Public Health Association, told the outlet he was unaware of any data supporting Kennedy and Co.'s claims. "Are they making this decision without going to any of their advisory committees?" Benjamin said. "Show us the evidence, the studies that have been done. I don't know of any." In fact, the CDC has previously said pregnant people are at higher risk of becoming very ill from COVID and are at an increased risk of pregnancy complications, including stillbirth. Last year, a study from the Cleveland Clinic, published in the EMBO Journal, showed that the mild and asymptomatic SARS-CoV-2 infections can trigger immune responses in a pregnant individual that may cause serious inflammatory responses in the developing fetus. Receiving the vaccine during pregnancy also provides protection for newborn babies who are at high risk of developing serious complications. "It's really concerning," Sean O'Leary, MD, chair of the American Academy of Pediatrics Committee on Infectious Diseases, told NPR. "I think it's going to be confusing not only for parents, but also public health professionals and medical professionals as well. This takes away choice." Stephen J. Fleischman, MD, president of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists, said in a statement, "As OBGYNs who treat patients every day, we have seen firsthand how dangerous COVID infection can be during pregnancy and for newborns who depend on maternal antibodies for vaccine protection. From the vaccine for protection, the science has not changed. It is very clear that COVID infection during pregnancy can be catastrophic and lead to major disability." Currently, the CDC website states that COVID vaccination for children is safe, that getting vaccinated helps protect children against COVID-19, and that children who have already had COVID-19 should still get vaccinated. Kennedy is, of course, a longtime anti-vaxxer who has falsely claimed the COVID vaccine was the deadliest vaccine ever made. He once involved himself in a vaccine controversy in Samoa and traveled to the country to amplify local anti-vaccine advocates months before a deadly measles outbreak killed 83 people on the island nation. Earlier this month, amidst the measles outbreak in the U.S., he ordered federal agencies to find new treatments for the disease, despite the vaccine being widely effective. Bess Levin is really railing on RFK Jr. this week. Her next headline, RFK Jr. and the worm that ate his brain threatened to ban government scientists from publishing in top medical journals. Do you feel healthier already? This is on May 28th. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said Tuesday that he will likely ban government scientists from publishing research in top medical journals, because why disseminate important knowledge that could advance human health when you could just log on to TikTok and hear what a MAHA influencer has to say about seed oils and beef tallow? Appearing on the podcast, Ultimate Human, the Health and Human Services Secretary, who doesn't seem to know, among so many other things, the difference between viral and bacterial infections, declared, "We're probably going to stop publishing in The Lancet, New England Journal of Medicine, JAMA, published by the American Medical Association, and those other journals, because they're all corrupt." He claimed the journals are controlled by the pharmaceutical industry. As the Washington Post notes, the publications cited by Kennedy, a former heroin addict who once staged an elaborate bear cub murder scene in Central Park, play a central role in disseminating medical findings worldwide and are read by millions of people. But fear not. Yes, government scientists may no longer be allowed to share information in legitimate peer-reviewed journals, but they will be able to put their research in brand new periodicals that Kennedy says his department is going to create. Papers demonstrating the safety and efficacy of vaccines, probably not allowed. Speaking to the Post, Adam Gaffney, a public health researcher and Harvard Medical School assistant professor, noted the absurdity of Kennedy's idea, saying that banning NIH-funded researchers from publishing in leading medical journals and requiring them to publish only in journals that carry the RFK Jr. seal of approval would delegitimize taxpayer-funded research. The likely journal ban, the news of which comes as Kennedy's department is frozen funds for medical research and purged 20,000 HHS employees, with the secretary doing everything in his power to delegitimize sound science, will no doubt inspire U.S. scientists to seek out work abroad. Also on Tuesday, Kennedy released a video on social media in which he said his department was no longer recommending COVID vaccines for healthy pregnant women and children, despite the Center for Disease Control and Prevention currently advising that all Americans 6 months and older receive the updated vaccine, and warning that pregnant people who contract the virus can be at risk of serious illness and complications that include preterm labor and stillbirth. Boy, I have missed Bess Levin and the Levin Report. This brings us to the end of our time together here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and my name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thank you so much for tuning in. I invite you to join me next week. We're going to have another full hour of current events and Hollywood stories and politics, and now I can also say Bess Levin reports. So thank you again for listening, and have a great week, everybody.